Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the December 2024 edition of Poet Radio. On the program this month, we're featuring the work of Will Alexander, who was recently in the area lecturing, reading, and edifying students at Bard College. Will is a Los Angeles-based writer, visual artist, and musician whose works are influenced by surrealism, negritude, and many other forces. He was previously a guest on the program during summer of 2020, a session you can review via the vast WGXC archive. What you'll be hearing tonight is recordings I made of the first half of his lecture at Bard, segments from a post-visit cell phone interview, and excerpts from his reading at Bard earlier this month. Hyperspatial Rotation, Poetic Circular Deepening was the title designated for the presentation Will gave as the Leslie Scalapino Lecture in Innovative Poetics at Bard College on December 2nd. Here's the first part of Will's talk.
And I never read when I do lectures. I just work with things.
Speaking of alchemy.
Sun Ra says when the lights go off, something's happening. So I guess something's happening.
Yeah.
And you know, first of all, I'm gonna read a little bit, but I'm just gonna talk really. But this, first of all, I'll say Leslie Scalapino was never a lustreless cameo. She was never rooted in appearance, but was endemically nourished by her poetic temperament. And this temperament goes back to the spark of oxygen on this earth 1.7 billion years ago. That's how long it took the human race to start evolving. By the way, the human eye didn't start evolving, it started evolving 500 million years ago. So, you know, we're a process of evolution. But I'll just continue what I'm saying here. She's a magical concurrence that goes back to what I understand to be the asymptotic riches of the firmament. For instance, the poetic sensibility is riddle that issues from the asymptotic temperament, subconsciously Uranian and scale that naturally lends itself to supraconsciousness. A scale that becomes as mysterious hyperbolics that extends to its way into speech, into a rotational forum that magnetizes oral magnetics, thus always charged by atmospheric mystery. That's what poetry does. It's atmospheric mystery. It doesn't conjoin by linear thought. This is what we, as poets, we all get into trouble with linear thought. Personally, I think Leslie had that problem. I wouldn't call it a problem, but it's a way of being in the world that it's been too conscripted to the so-called suburbs of the psyche. But to get into the main instance of the spinning mind into the spontaneous mind, one has to go back to a little known thinker that people don't know about, Edward de Bono. The lateral thinking work, where you just don't use linear thinking, but the way that the thought works, that's like he uses these categories like suspended judgment. And it doesn't go in a linear line. So the linear line has been so conscripted for so long that poets are relegated to the outskirts, except in places like Iran and Mexico and indigenous cultures around the globe. But when you're a poet in the first world and in the higher reaches of capital, they ascribe you to the outside, to a kind of existential minimum. But you're in this existential minimum all the time as a writer, so people just leave you alone. Like I was in Beijing with Elliot Weinberger recently, and he said, since the people were reading my books, he said I'd be on a griddle. But people in power really don't read poetry. Once in a while, you know, there's an expert, you know, with the problem with the Nobel Prize with Emmett Cesaire. And, you know, I was told that Emmett Cesaire was, Octavio Paz was really riddled because Emmett hadn't won a Nobel. And as Clayton Eshelman once said, Emmett Cesaire should have won 4 or 5 Nobels. But because he wrote that book, Discourse on Colonialism, it's staggering. It remains an incredible document, which has been an incredible inspiration for me in my odyssey about writing on subjects and that, like this new book I have coming out entitled On Dar'el Hijra, this educational process of psychic Islamic thought, say 1,000 years ago. But in saying all this, I want to bring Leslie into this diverse plethora of knowledge that she carried, always tinged by her trips to the Far East. And all this travel was traveling in the psychic bloodstream, a contagion, if you will, a powerful contagion of not of leprosy, but of endemic brewing. Poetry in itself brews. It has to brew, and it has to brew in silence, like seeds do from tremendous oaks. But they don't brew in the open. You know, René Guénon says that there's always a hatred of secrecy in the Occident because people want you to show everything that you know all the time, to show up your best. I analogize it to a cocktail party where you want to show off superficial knowledge. Well, I'll say, honestly, I don't have superficial knowledge to show off, and I'm glad I don't. Because, you know, one of Tolstoy's favorite poets was Nekrasov, a stable boy. You know, so, in other words, poetry rises from inside, not outside. We're taught about the inside of things by poetry. But, you know, in the advertising world, it's interesting, and André Breton wanted to meet with Freud, but it was Freud's nephew, Bernays, who got the advertising industry started 100 years ago. So what do people want to do now? They want to go to Bernays. What about Breton's connection with Freud? Breton was not an ideologist that people think that he is now. Also, they call him the Pope of Surrealism. Not the Pope of Surrealism, but a person who ascribed the automatic pulse to people like Shakespeare and Jonathan Swift. So we're not talking about ideology here. We're talking about a living element that, as I said, started as a factor on Earth 1.7 billion years ago when the nature of oxygen began to rise into the atmosphere. It's interesting what people are doing today. They want to ascribe that 1.7 billion years to astronomical exploration, that there's lights of a civilization, post-colonialism, on, was it Proxima B? Yeah, in the Alpha Centauri system. And it is supposed to be lights on Alpha Centauri laid out like a grid that's habitable in origin to the present circumstance of this particular madness that we're going through on this Earth. But it doesn't work that way. Poetry goes into mystery. Like Leslie, going always into mystery, not putting all, you can't put all your cards on the table in the first place. You just can't, because poetry is so instantaneous. I remember riding in a crowded bus one day, and this line came to me. It was a fragment of a line. I said, I gotta write this down, and I'm so glad I did. Unknown bus riders, crowded, didn't have a pencil ready, but I managed to get a small pen and put the scribblings down. The line was, as rare as a live Aegean rhino. It was just something that was fresh. You know, poetry has to be fresh. It can't be somewhat temperamental, where you take some lines that you've copied from somebody else and added a little bit of your own. But, you know, Satyavya Pass says, it can be nice meters and nicely balanced, but is there poetry in it? So for me, I want to keep, I like to balance lines. I hear in balance, but what's in the lines is not balanced logically. It's not balanced. It's just the script. And so I hear all the time, the great firmament is hearing. It's like Michel Levy says, for all the sorrows you go through in life as a poet, that first line that you get as a bolt out of the blue is a blessing all the time. So you want to catch that blessing all the time. You've got to live in poetry. For me, I live in poetry like 24/7. It's a 24/7 cycle. And Bob Carbon said the same thing. I'm not copying him, but it's something that I do as a living being. Sometimes it creates obstacles, but the measure is the reward that poetry gives you. I continue to write, and each book, I'm not looking for outside recognition, but from what's drawing from the inside out. Not the external applause, but it comes, that kind of thing is incidental because it comes and goes. And where are you at 3:30 in the morning when lines come to you? That's how I write, 24/7 cycle. So I try to keep a pencil or some instrument ready that I can put it down where it's immediate and it's fresh. It's like you take something out of the oven, it's fresh. You don't want used copies in your mind where it looks good. But you know, all work has to balance. All language has to balance. The cosmos itself erratically balances all the time. But it's not the way you think of it logically. But poetry has that kind of cosmic balance all the time. So, as the late Malcolm X said, I'm not an expert on anything. But as I said earlier, you know, Bucky Fuller was a kind of person that said, look, the person who runs the ship, the captain can schwab a deck, he can cook a meal, he can fire a gun. That's what he called a general comprehensivist. You have to, as poet, you have to be a general comprehensivist. And you know, it's a poet I'm not quite conversant with yet in terms of influence, but the late Robert Frost says it's like walking across a thorn field with boots. You just pick up thorns. You know, you just pick up random things. So in that sense, you're not a complete dry scholar. But your scholarship is endemic to your person, and it comes out naturally where the words aren't big, but they're telepathic. They're not necessarily big, but even the articles are charged in the language. Everything has to be charged in the lingual field. It's not like you use things and take things out because they don't seem to be correct. There's no such thing as non-correctness. There is such a thing as non-correctness because this is what Cesar Vallejo came up with. He says that, I think as Philip Seymour Smith said in the 80s, he's a British thinker on poetics, nobody was hired in Cesar Vallejo and Gerasim Luca because they could hear that existentially hear that particleized level, that level of those particular levels of poetry where they glance off, the words glance off of each other. As Vallejo once put it, telluric and magnetic. Mm-hmm. You've got to have the courage to go out there and, like Vallejo, and not to copy him, but to search through trash cans, like Artaud. And these are hard moments. Gerasim Luca jumping off into the sin as his final action in life. But we're not asking people, I don't ask people to do that, but to work out of that spirit of, for me, desperation. Non-understanding is part of the situation one goes through in life. You're not conscripted to the life that the prosaic life tries to give you and enforce upon you as to being intelligent. I read a small article one day, very small article in the Los Angeles Times. He was a person at a small school here in Connecticut. And he says, my best students are my C students. You know, because they work harder. I was not a great student, but I'm here talking to you guys because I've been working 24/7. As Leslie, we work all the time. Poets work all the time when nobody's working. That's the key. Don't be there as a theatrical ornament, but be there when nobody's home and you're working all the time. When nobody seems to care, it's a holiday, it's Thanksgiving, and your cousins are telling you, why don't you come out of the room? Because the ideas hit me at that time. Poetry doesn't care about prosaic time schedules. It comes, for instance, a line could come to me as I speak to you. I don't want to just break my talk up, but this is how magical it is.
That was Will Alexander speaking at Bard College earlier this month. Unsurprisingly, I was inspired and provoked to speak with him about some of the concepts emerging from his talk as well as his current work in general, so I arranged to speak with him by phone this past Sunday, and here is some of that conversation. Probably the main message that I took away from that, overall message was one needs to be present all the time. That came through pretty clearly, and I know you to be that way. And are you just absorbing all the time, and you retain it?
Yeah, it's inner adventure via mystery, and there's like a desperation, as I was telling them at Harvard, like a Bud Powell saturation. You know, I can't do anything else but absorb. And vis-a-vis the mystery of the universe itself, and I'm on this adventure, this inner adventure all the time, and it continues to build and grow, and it's never static, never static. It's always a kinetic, informational complex, right, that one is involved with, a kinetic informational complex, and you know, grabbing shards and visions and whatever I can gather from experience on Earth, I'm going to continue doing it. You never get an answer. Cosmos doesn't answer for you.
Yeah.
But we're given a structure that's always this some palpable reality that we tend to be driven by. And at least I am, existentially driven by this impalpable reality that seems to be endless.
In the lecture, I found at least five different kind of definitions that you applied to it, and that was I'll just go through them and you can tell me if there's things that I missed or things you wanted to add. One was atmospheric mystery. One was that it gave you something like existential minimum, people just leave you alone. Poetry was brewing, poetry had to be fresh. Poetry was qualitative, not quantitative. And probably most significantly, you called it oral, A-U-R-A-L, astronomy. And this is a sort of interesting constellation of things to apply to poetry.
Well, all the above. I would say all of those things were I never for me, it's always swirling. All those informational complexes are always swirling and always breaking off, scattering and regenerating it simultaneously all the time. So it gives one internal power somehow did lose his own internal power. And I just reflect on things that there's always an opening for new work all the time. You know, I never one's never static. One's always inwardly kinetic. And, you know, I just did a poem on this Cameroonian volcano that erupted around the time of Chernobyl. And Césaire, I'd never talked about Césaire much really recently, but I was talking about Césaire's understanding of that insight of this qualitative listing of by the West, you know, or the Occident, you know, when Chernobyl had this situation, it was continuously done, but I never heard about this Cameroonian, you know, it was like almost like a cryovolcano, this explosion that consumed people in the capital of Cameroon. You know, it's over 1,000 animals suffocated by this volcanic gas and ether, and you know, over 1,000 beings disintegrated, and I never even heard about it. I never heard about it. Nobody's heard about it. Lake Neo, yeah. And the volcanic, yeah, nobody, NYO, it's NYO. Anyway, I just finished that, and just working on that understanding of how ozone works. And then as you go along with things, you just pick up new informational complexes all the time. And what I've discovered in the poem is that you go into volcanology or astronomy, you know, it's incredible poetic phrases in there, incredible poetic phrases. And in some, that's what I'm really working with, this whirlwind of energies.
And the other thing that comes through is, and you talk about, is your music and the painting and the writing. And I was wondering, here you're talking about poetry, and I asked you about poetry, so that makes sense. But I was wondering, and we heard you play a little piano at Bard, which was nice, but I'm wondering if writing is still primary, is that what you gravitate towards first? It sort of seems that way to me, although we know you're involved with other things.
Yeah, it would be a generating principle. Poetry is a generating principle. Although I've never been enlivened by Cocteau, but Jean Cocteau said that the generating principle is the writing, is the poetry, from which all things occur. And that's where, you know, things are for me. So I generate off that central core of understanding. In fact, when I play the piano, I work off of what I consider to be visual, not non-musical scores. Visual scores that are just endemic to me. You know, as I play the piano as if I were drawing.
Who else has talked about that? Has anybody else ever talked about that? Music is drawing?
No, you know, I don't think so. I mean, There was a piano player that Ornette Coleman discovered in 1965. In fact, he only did one or two recordings over his lifetime. Interesting man. Went to school at Harvard, brother, 65. Hmm. And Ornette found him. I can't think of his name right now for some reason. It's me. But he played like, he was not a musical person. He was a scientific person, but he was drawing from those same sources. So I made up I've created this spontaneous vocabulary over time where I just work with sound. I hear the sound, and I just hear it like I'm drawing it.
Yeah.
And I hear it spontaneously, and I just blend in with just the sonic context of the sonic complex of the informational that's generating for me.
Right.
That's generating the context. And in fact, that's why I did the small thing at Bard, you know, with in front of the, they call themselves the Sun Ra players, you know, and it was a class with Angelica. I played for Angelica Sanchez's class.
Yeah.
And I worked with, I can't think of Marshall's name, but they know him. You know, he's like a circular Andrew Surreal type drummer. And we just fell in and did this set, and that was great, and it worked.
Now that I heard you speaking of this and even thinking about the concept, there was an obvious example of Cecil, who, you know, his scores were visual, many of them. And I hadn't remembered that until you just jogged my memory on it.
Interesting, interesting. Well, you know, that's where I'm at, you know. And anyway, here we are, you know, I'm in this zone and trying to get through this informational complex of living.
One of the things you said that I think got everybody's attention was that you had said that you had seen Thelonious Monk perform. And I was wondering where and what your memories of that were. This is just anecdotal, I realize. But still, that was, I don't know too many people who actually saw Monk.
Yeah, I did see Monk. I'll never forget. I have forgotten and remembered at the same time. He had a pickup trio. It wasn't people that I really knew, and I can't remember. And it was Lake Shelley Mann was there, and some of my Shelley's Manhole. That's where I saw Monk at. And some real heavy stuff in them days, man. Woo, heavy, man. I saw Jimmy Garrison play and Elvin. And
so was that
Saint Valence?
Early 70s or something? Or?
Yeah. It was late. It was that time period, you know. So I've been at this a while.
No, I know, yeah. I know. But here we are in a situation, and I think this is one of the things you were acknowledging, and I've been thinking of the world in this in terms of being a kind of very becoming more and more surreal itself.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Absolutely.
So I guess the question is kind of like, what's the best or most effective way to respond to that? Can we speak surrealism to surrealism?
Mm. We can't speak ideologically at all. We see as a natural evolution of this ideological, ideological level has transmuted, and their initial intuition was absolutely spot on, and there's, and that I'll call it it was pre-hesitation, the post-hesitation, Breton was able to garner through his psychological experiences what he was generating through the poetry itself. Mm. It was not limited by anything, but it's surrealism and painting. And as I mentioned at Harvard, Breton was not an ideologist. He wasn't a pope as such. Maybe superficially, but in the endemic writing of the manifesto, he mentions Shakespeare and Swift and other possibilities of the way that this realism is a perennial. Shakespeare and Swift is part of the endemics of writing. So it doesn't create itself via hesitation, but oral informational, from an oral informational complex.
Right.
That's where I'm at. It's oral informational complex.
Right. It's nothing that one forces. It's almost like
an organic
flow.
Exactly. And actually, the linear mind is part of that. I'm discovering that because there's so much material from astronomy and volcanism and volcanics and all kinds of forms of biology that I finally gotten to.
Yeah.
I don't depend on that, but it's part of the weaving of listening. As I said that, you know, what's his name? Edward de Bono understands that the linear mind is part of the complexity, but it shouldn't be, it is not the dominant mind. Mm-hmm. I'm transmuting that idea, so you know it's like I'm dealing with that transmutation all the time.
I totally hear you on that. People people want to believe that thought and action are linear, but it's never that.
No, it's never that.
The mind is, I mean, I don't, you know, I'm going to use a technological term here, but the mind is hypertext. The mind, you know, 10 seconds from now, I don't know what I'm going to say. I know you've been getting out lately and meeting interesting people along the way. You were here at Bard, you were in New York City, and you say you've been to Harvard. You're meeting all these interesting people, getting introduced to new ideas all along the way. Is there anything myself and listeners need to know about?
Yeah, well, I've been, I spontaneously got introduced to this Maria Martirosyan. She's a translator from Latvia. And I met her via a previous contact in London, who, Stephen Fowler. I don't know if you know him. It was 3 a.m. and he introduced me to her. And we've been having sessions where she's been taking parts of my work and translating them into Russian.
Wow, and, great.
And so she's up at Stanford now. She's in graduate school up there. She's just eating it up. And, you know, we just have this kind of a opaque condensation of energies that because I don't speak Russian, but she speaks English. And so it seems to somehow work. And anyway, we've been talking. He introduced, you know, us via long range, but we're like Hessel talked about these strange butterflies meeting in the forest. I mean, moths and butterflies meeting out from long distance. And here we are, you know, with the same kind of aural sensibilities. Mm. And it's hard to find this kind of real aural sensibility. It's not a visual sensibility. So this is who you should know, and this is, you guys have everything in common, but it's not like that. That's right. For me, a superficial level, but this is the aural level. And I have these aural combinations with the people, like unlikely aural conversations where things match. You know, it's nonlinear. And I'm working with a radio project here, and an underground radio project for one of my plays. I've written my first libretto.
All right.
For this work. It's a play called Conduction in the Catacombs.
Wow.
And man, it's about two mentally ill patients and Spanish speakers who but it's not an they work in English, obviously, but one's from Brazil and one's from Mexico, and they're just in the same asylum, and they snipe at each other. One is called Cortenia. She's the sun around which this Eurydice is, you know, circles like a planet. And they Eurydice accuses the other one, Cortenia, of being sand blind. Wow. And the other one is more angular and gaunt, and Cortenia is a bit corpulent, and you know, and they go back and forth with each other in this insane asylum in West Texas. Jeez. And this is in fact, it's been performed one time, like, wow, and I can't get my plays out. I can't do nothing with them. In fact, I got to do a mailing right now to a person, to Litmus Press, and, you know, I've been trying to, I tell you, the whole of 2019, I typed this book up of plays. It took me all that time, and I don't know if I have them all ready to go, but the book is called Treason in the Northern Theater.
Wow.
And one of the plays was kind of like an Ionesco's takeoff. I don't know if I can find that. It was called Infant, where the mother is a Filipina gambler that lives in Monaco or somewhere like that. And his father is what is his father? He's a Bataille-esque, like George Bataille. Mm. But he's in a wheelchair, and he's a veteran, and he's in a wheelchair, and and she's a gambler, and you just call the play is just called Infant. An infant is a piano player and a chess player. Wow. So anyway, that's one of the plays.
That's the latest from Will Alexander, commenting on his work, practice, and processes. Will has had a prodigious run of years and has at least three more new books on the horizon in 2025, Astonishing Index Phantoms, Interior Philosophical Fractals, and Texas Blind Salamander Feelings. At Bard, Will turned to a good bit of material from the late 90s, particularly the volume Above the Human Nerve Domain, as well as from more recent works. This is Will Alexander reading at Bard on December 3rd, 2024.
I'll read another from this volume here. It's called The Telepathic Carnivore. The fleece of its ubiquitous mineral body, like a blinded port in the midst of the sea, the lion, Panthera, Leo, a double gender on land, a carnivore which gallops across the open floor of the galaxy. The lion, extended by a sun-fed carnaba, fending off the ambush of sleep, fending off its rivals, camouflaged like an invisible nightmare pony. In its vistas, telepathy as carnivorous ignition, as a flame which ascends through rivalrous stampedes, the lion, Panthera Leo, seeming to draw to its powers the pronotation of spirit, the central delta of its roaring. In its riddled mask of circumference, there is purity and status, there is its savagery of glass, monitored under stone, and its savagery absolutely non-monaxial, like a hollowed flame in the flask of its teeth, full of running oils and momentary lavas, capable of hunting in a haunted neutron savanna, which eradicates its dialectical wound marks, dragging its vermiculate prey through narrowed sluice, the narrow sluice of an alien solar vicinity. This lion, part whirlwind and androsphinx, part juniper branch, part cyclone as flaw, because it weighs in its moon's invisible vampire feathers in general brush lightning deserts. Its obscurity torrential, by which pythons rest, by which leopards implode. Yes, it lives by hieroglyphs of negated luminosity, by which spells are lengthened, by which tree lines are convened. So the lion, struggling with alchemical swine in its fleece, in its feral vacillations, so that the curvature of its eyes, capable of detecting the pivotal postulates of hydrogen, so that the deprived scorching of its sound, capable of advancing a strengthened helium soil, so that its searing, its devious restoration comes to a balance in a strange and demanding optical palette, which lingers in pure water and explosive ozone, dear, the ambiguities being rampant, the movement boiling. The lion now, telepathic under plankton, under greenish snowfall ravines, Panthera, Leo, instantaneous with its genetic deflection across demons, thereby singing in its skin to the color which flows in a transcendental verbal swagger. For instance, for me, everything is a poetic consequence. Everything that you see, and it's how you instantaneously transmute the audit powers. You take it into your system, and it transmutes into another kind of glow and another kind of level or the kind of power of schism. And this is entitled, Within the Opaque Termites Morass. They of collided pincer malfunction, of egregious clashings of dread, of the privity of corroded malarial witness embedded in a boiling worm foundation. This life conducted in a smoky, horrific substratum fed by miraculous enmity, by seismic fault, by brittle torrential mound, by blank tornado morass. Each haunted aspiration within imploded flanks of soil, within its rotted neon stochastic. And these implosions burn and scatter their inversions as if wheat were being pictured in the elusive flash of primordial fungus, crystallized by acidic fallopian fate, by a forge of molecules scattered as oblivious distraction. The life which functions as a limitless biochemical mortality, as an alchemical ridge or an asteroidal morgue. They who eat flames from exploded rain sieves, who take as status vicious armaments of wood under blank absorption suns, moving like a voracious flood of pale neutrino trout, stunning and vulnerable like a scurrilous cortical mimetic beneath a flask of exploded grain in a well, or a cloudy reptilian salt where genetic abasement burns and ghostly electrodes extend into treeless electrical shocks and gullies. And from this intensity, a leap of telepathic kindling from the poles of Alpha Centauri, from a pre-existent wormwood, from a riveted fire on Callisto. Therefore, from old oppositional lightnings, from its fleece of flames, flaming thistles, there comes to exist an alien iridium lantern with its instantaneous beam, which penetrates the thorax, which coils and recoils the termites' impact antennae as they ceaselessly inflame the wrenching leonine soils. So for me, everything is really living, highly and abstract at the same time. The material world and the levels above it or below it. For me, I've always taken into consideration that which rises above the mind. Not below, but above the mind, the supramental. Aurobindo calls it the supramental plane. This is where we don't live in the current world or in the West. This is where we need to go on to other spirals of infinity. It's within us too, we can go on these spirals, but you know, people take their spurs from the outside world to the ends and try to move on the inside with the outside, but it doesn't work as a natural flow or a chronicle that lifts itself from the main. It lifts itself from the, how could I say, the transactional. Most poetry is unfortunately too transactional. And if you read Philip Lamartine's old essay, what's his name? It's Poetic Matters, it's the name of it. He says most poetry, it's equivalent to Time Magazine or Newsweek. It's too grounded. It doesn't take chances with itself. So that's the whole thing for me, is just take chances with the imagination. Sometimes the verb will turn into a noun or things switch around, like Vallejo's work, you know, you have all these different kinds of power, and it creates power. These frictions create power. Gerasim Luca, another, frictions create power. Vallejo, the things create power and you can rise from this power, not ideological impulse, but by a living impulse that allows you to surmount hunger and dearth and all kinds of phantoms that come in and out of a poet's life. This caught me by surprise, finishing in the finalist for the Pulitzer, but I never write for awards. I just write for what I think is my own worth, invisibly. And so here we go. I'll try several more here. By the way, I never script these readings out. I'll just give you what I got. And this is basically it. We'll do what we say we're going to do by reading A Blaze of Riddles. Because the sun exudes a blaze of riddles, there exists a haze of optimal osmosis, of protracted helium that bends via its forceless gruel, via its maniacal translocation to alien ravines, to other planes and possibilities anterior to the sense of chronicle as uninhabited or pure activity. You know, that's something about the anterior mind. We were talking about Tracy the other day about the anterior consciousness. We always think about being saved in the end. But what about what happened before this happened? You know, that the earth was ignited as we know it, 1.7 billion light years before this moment. And you know, we think about what's going to save you, but we already were saved when the chemicals of oxygen were already configuring in the reality of this planet 1.7 billion light years, a billion years ago. So now we're talking about going into light year expanse. But we don't know what has ignited our reality that we take for granted. So the poet makes note of things like these things that go unnoted all the time. We're always thinking about crevices, small motes of dust. They come to you and you can begin to mine these small things. The small animal that we just swat away that has a nervous system, a complexity. We don't know how it got there. We really don't. We can study it, but that study to me is an aftermath, because all our mathematics and all our acquisitiveness comes from the universe itself. And I'm not trying to give you wisdom, but this is the way that it comes to me. And I'm just going to turn some pages here and pick out a poem. In a pitch dark sailing house, when all the lights go off and you don't know where you're at, even though you know where you're at, but you don't. And here we are on this earth. We know where we're at, but we don't know where we're at in our lives. None of us do. In a pitch dark sailing house, Vertiginous in a pitch dark sailing house, as alienated spinning figment, I ambulate as galling paper road, as phantoms blazing in and out of consciousness, as otherness, as alienated other, peering down on myself from a cold, evil sky, facing a scale that enters ashes, as a chronicle of non-sequiturs, being raised from Saturnian winds. Because there exists nothing except nothing I can squander, nothing that curious bookcases brew, so that fire appears from urns, as if it were territorial omen, as electrocuted scar, alive, as magical utterance, as roughish self-specified and opening form onto random scholarly dust, thus asking myself the one line equation, the one line equation of how astonishment boils. Words come and you just work with them. And I don't want to get too scattered here. But, you know, we want to go back to the to articulate momentums of our own species. We are, to me, I'm speaking from a riddle all the time. I'm not speaking from scholarship. Nothing. I speak like Leonardo says, tell me if something was ever accomplished. So, this is called Life in Post-Socratic Biology. Body as dust leper, as central scorpion gladioli, as ferocious symbolical sapien, yes, as tribe, as blaze, as hematopia or sputum, as sudden vascular blindness. Therefore, body as remolded algae, as transacted powder, as Greek and umbrageous bondage. Again, its substance as rudiment, as seed, as monster in Ionian tundra, as subconscious yoke, as syllable, as spasm, as divided hunchback volcano. This being frontal being with its saffron vultures, with its shattered conquering piety, with its angry neutron adders. This being the muscular frontal boundary with its butchery is being, tantalic with a social debacle. Thus, as its treachery perceived in tangled post-mortem findings, in hives, in prefabricated bastions, in broken Tokyo mutton. Then the grafts, the poison beach contusions, the twisted contact roses, the darkened side effects, the extruded evanescence, the clustered being in a burning lake of moons. Across a range of limited lateral valleys, as in collapsing X-ray corruption, as in ruins of haunted sanguinary motions. The being then listless, and nothing less than a body, nothing less than a didactic icon with its onerous flame, with a taint that seeps from a conquered fractional salt. Here we are as conquered fractional salt, trying to move through our pathways to life. We don't know where we're going. It's, I call it, provision for the higher ozone body. A beaker of yeast on a phantom blood horizon, sustaining my stoma, my triangular body as hearth, while imbibing hyperphrenia in the void of a dusty electrical house. Alive in a vanished ozone square like a magic hydrogen beast in a jewel, honing my priority to elevated ferret, to quantifiable opacity, in that I'm able to hunt for trout in plentiful sucrose heat, in fiery ratios of bark and gulfs of angry neutron data. Because I claim the fructose of flesh with splinters, I agree upon darkened chemical plants to take away sequentials, to reinforce the blood which ignites the omniscient smoke of ritual Cherokee spiders. Much like the power to secretly ingest hemp, to curiously spill water, feasting within the sands of alchemical Polynesias, within blazing stochastics, eating sheets of interior hawk, or anomalous dandelion lashings, or ice from cold cilantro chowders. Or say I drank blood from a haphazard sparrow, or swallow peppers from a swirling Mongolian leper's nest. I'm linked to primordial kerosene examples, to floods,
to symbols of Assyrian hunting assemblage. Displaced and obsessed with contaminated grammar, which forfeits prophetic ore or the force of Uranian cobalt figments, I mellifluously rise into a higher thermal assertion by pulling intuitive stones around a sink of explosive shadows. I then re-engender the bottomless and make two or three bickerings of ice vanish into the source of Mexican agua. There then exists the eating of lions on the behalf of alchemical hurricane bodies, on behalf of its higher levitational beryllium, its claws, its emblems of eclectic butane and voltage, and it is this voltage by which one staggers like an amethyst fish, like a monstrous chaparral of limits on fire, with that which annuls the lower gold to a higher state of buffeted emergence. As if under the camouflage of cataracts, I were to dwell on glassy vertigo soils, compelled by roaring anodyne volcanoes. Every reason exists to impose my scrolls on blank omega warrants. Therefore, being able to breathe at living volitional scale, life a spurious mirror that must be emptied, must transcend the flaw in piacular bullocks, so that the bulk, the monorons, the chasms, will emit as oracular bounty, a salt, a distance princed, capable of a less at the pitch of the transmuted ozone body. So to me, it's always this flash of seeming interference, but it allows you to to rise above that tang, that transactional entanglement, which you want to rise above.
Once again, you've been listening to excerpts from Will Alexander's reading at Bard College earlier this month. My name is Chris Funkhauser. That wraps it up for Poet Radio this year. I hope everyone has a pleasurable holiday season and we'll catch up with each other next year. Please stay tuned to WGXC, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Radio for Open Ears.